This is OPB News. I'm Christian Foden-Bensel. Three sea lions have snacked on endangered salmon for the last time. The three were captured in the Columbia River yesterday and are now destined to live out their days at SeaWorld. State wildlife agents will return to the river next week to trap and relocate more hungry sea lions. Killing them's not allowed for now. Correspondent Tom Bonsi has more on the start of the roundup.
Wildlife biologists have a list of repeat customers at the threatened salmon cafe. The buffet lies in the Columbia River just below Bonneville Dam.
We have about 70 animals on the list. And so we think that these are the experienced animals that have been here, many of them multiple years.
Guy Norman says you can strike three California sea lions off the list. Norman supervises sea lion control for Washington State's Department of Fish and Wildlife.
We are hoping that as we remove experienced animals, the new animals that may come in will be more naive and perhaps more responded to our non-lethal hazing.
Norman says in this face-off of species versus species, the protected but abundant sea lions must yield to the salmon. Federal studies blame sea lions for consuming about 4% of the spring run. Norman was part of a crowd of wildlife agents watching two floating cages anchored just downriver from the Bonneville fish ladder. Sea lions have become accustomed to resting on the platforms, barks and bellows carried across the water when cage doors suddenly slammed shut. Patrol boats swarmed around the traps. Notorious sea lions were identified by brands or markings and prodded into crates for transport. The commotion attracted a parade of onlookers, mostly local fishermen. Bill Ritchie of Skamania, Washington, fears that sea lions will annihilate Columbia River sturgeon if left to their devices.
Well, I really was hoping when I stopped here that they would be doing something permanent about it, you know, getting rid of them, killing them. They ought to do something.
Oregon and Washington applied for and received permission to kill up to 85 sea lions per year, but a federal appeals court has put that on hold. The Humane Society argued that the sea lions are being made a scapegoat for the salmon's decline, while bigger culprits escape. Marine Mammal Coordinator Sharon Young says the Humane Society objects to sea lion capture as well as killing, but decided not to make a stink about it.
The trapping is something that we've always said we believe is unnecessary, but at this point we would focus our efforts on trying to prevail in our ultimate arguments with the court.
Young fears sea lion capture or killing will turn into an endless cycle as new arrivals replace those removed. The Northwest states have located new homes for 20 problem sea lions at zoos and marine parks around the country. After that quota is filled, what happens next depends on the outcome of the Humane Society lawsuit. Another round of legal briefs is due next month. I'm Tom Bonsi near Bonneville Dam on the Columbia River.
Across the country, homeless people are able to keep in touch with case managers or follow job leads through a free voicemail system. For 15 years, Community Voicemail, as the Seattle-based program is called, has been giving phone numbers to people in crisis. From Seattle, Ruby DeLuna has the story of one man who says a voicemail got him out of homelessness.
You have reached the office of Rich Wilson. Thank you for calling. Please leave a message.
This is Richard Wilson's voicemail box. You probably picture a man behind a desk. But when Wilson got his box from Community Voicemail, he was homeless. For Wilson, it's more than just a message center. It's a lifeline.
It was the thread of communication to the world and to all the things, all the people that I needed to be in contact with in order for me to battle back, survive, stay alive, press on.
Voicemail was the first thing Wilson got from a social worker the month his life unraveled. It was December 2006. He lost his home, an insurance business he'd built from scratch. He was $25,000 in debt, 62 years old. Wilson says his problems stemmed from his mental health.
I have severe and extreme PTSD. On top of chronic depression. Which has occurred since I left the military during the Vietnam era.
Wilson says community voicemail has been the one stable thing in his life. For the past 15 months, he's lived in transitional homes, navigated the social service system, and looked for work. Today, he works part-time at a Home Depot. He has an apartment. For a while, no one, not even his employer, knew he was homeless. That's the goal behind community voicemail, to serve as an equalizer for people who are phoneless and actively seeking help to improve their lives. Today, about 400 cities across the country, including Portland and Salem, Oregon, offer community voicemail. The nonprofit wants to do more and realizes it can.
Last month, we sent you a message to encourage you to get your taxes done for free by qualified volunteers.
CVM has become a giant intercom. Case managers use the system to tell clients about services. Steve Albertson is CVM's new initiatives director.
Around the country, different managers of our programs in some of these geographies are now starting to send daily job announcements, hurricane emergency information in places like Houston, information about available flu shots, things about free tax preparation services.
To find a free tax preparation site in your area, simply dial 211 from any phone in King County. This is a free call.
People who are generally, who don't have a home or are not getting even junk mail in the mail, they're still in need of information. And so we're actually looking to push more information out to people intelligently than just have a number that they can give to other people.
The next step for community voicemail is to offer low-cost recycled cell phones and prepaid phone cards. This is crucial as public payphones are disappearing. Richard Wilson recently bought a phone card to stay in touch with his grandsons, but he says he's not ready to give up his community voicemail box, not just yet.
I'm still in survival mode. I'll know when that moment arrives, when I can make the transition.
Wilson hopes that transition will come soon as he looks for a full-time job. His life has been rearranged in the last 15 months, but Wilson also feels that through hard times, he's been given a second chance. I'm Ruby DeLuna in Seattle.
Sky-high food prices are affecting Oregonians all over the state. Compared with most people, U.S. citizens pay relatively little for food, but nonetheless, people here are feeling the pinch. Wholesale foods giants Costco and Sam's Club have put a cap on the amount of rice customers can buy because of rising prices and limited supply. The Oregon Food Bank is chief among those affected locally by these kind of moves. Rachel Bristol is the executive director of the statewide hunger relief group. She says she doesn't expect the situation to get better for several years.
It's unbelievable some of the price increases we're seeing. Flour up 86% in a period of 6 months. Between March and April, margarine, a case of margarine went up 30%. So, and that's buying it at wholesale by the truckload.
Bristol says they are quite concerned that as the cost of gas soars, more people will be needing services like the Oregon Food Bank. And of course, rising gas prices ultimately impact the price of food too. Whether or not people are donating less to food banks because of higher prices isn't known yet, but Bristol says companies have fewer surpluses to sell cheaply or give away, and hunger relief workers are already seeing another effect of rising prices.
We do see it in terms of volunteers. We're hearing from agencies all over the state, but particularly those in rural areas, that the number of volunteers have declined because, you know, often there are retirees, again, on fixed incomes, and they can't afford the extra gas in their car.
Bristol says food banks are eyeing a proposed new farm bill. In Congress, it would increase funding for the funding food stamp program. She says it's been 30 years since the food stamp program saw an increase. President Bush has vowed to veto both a House and a Senate version of that bill. This week, the Pennsylvania primary produced lots of headlines. The results mean the Democratic struggle between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton continues. Here in Oregon, Congressman David Wu endorsed Obama. As our state moves into the national spotlight, our political analyst Bill Lunch has joined us here in Portland to review what happened and the implications for the state. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Christian.
So let's take the endorsement of Wu first. As soon as he announced his decision, it was headline news, and clearly Wu's important figure here in Oregon as one of the only five members of the House. But his endorsement seems to be producing national attention. Why is that?
Well, the short answer is that Wu has been one of only about 300 superdelegates nationally who have not declared their preference between Obama and Clinton. So Wu's getting a lot of attention, as he should, because he's among 300 what might be called voters, delegates that is, who are probably going to determine the next presidential nomination for the Democrats. The Democratic nomination rules were changed in the early 80s precisely to provide tiebreakers in case of a near tie. But this is the first time that a tie or anything remotely approaching it has developed in the Democratic presidential primaries and caucuses. And because Democrats use proportional representation to award the what are called pledge delegates, the remaining primaries are very unlikely to give either Obama or Clinton the numbers necessary to win the nomination without help from the superdelegates. Mm-hmm. So every one of them is vitally important.
Yeah. So following Pennsylvania, there are 9 contests left before the Democratic convention. The next round will be on May 6th in Indiana and North Carolina, and then West Virginia a week after that. But it appears that the Oregon primary on the 20th is going to get attention it hasn't received since, you know, we're told 1968. Can that be right?
It is right. The Oregon primary was very important in 1968, as it had been a number of times earlier. But in that year, only 14 states held primaries. Most delegates were selected at that time in closed caucuses, that is, party leaders such as Mayor Richard Daley in Chicago, to pick a famous one, chose delegates from among their political allies. And those folks used primaries as a rough measure of electability. They paid attention. But primaries didn't elect most delegates, as they now do. There was a revolt against that old system after the 1968 elections. And so now something like 70% of the states have presidential primaries. The Oregon primary, but as a result, one of the earlier mm-hmm. ones, became much less significant than it had been until this year.
I see. Well, so I noticed the day after the Pennsylvania primary, the Clinton campaign challenged Obama to 2 debates here in Oregon. You know, if they take place, could such debates move Clinton into a lead here?
Anything is possible. As your question suggests, current polling has Obama ahead in Oregon, as he is in North Carolina. Clinton is ahead, if the polls are right, as they were in Pennsylvania, in 2 states, West Virginia and Kentucky. She has been ahead in Indiana, but the polls there have now shown a race that is tightening up too close to call. Coming back to Oregon, the Clinton camp sees, or they think they see, the possibility of changing the outcome. If she could do that, it would be very significant. Not because of the delegates chosen here. There's only 65 of them, and only 52 of those will be selected in the primary. But because if she could win in either of the 2 states where Obama is thought to be ahead, it might well change the perceptions of the superdelegates back to those folks. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the same is true in reverse for Obama. So he'll be putting on major league efforts in West Virginia and Kentucky as well as Indiana. The key point is that, as in 1968, the remaining primaries are back to being important as illustrations of electability rather than because of the delegates formally selected.
I see. So after Oregon and Kentucky on May 20th, Montana and South Dakota will vote in early June, and those are the last 2 states to vote before the Democratic convention in August. So won't Montana and South Dakota get a lot of attention like Oregon?
Well, I haven't mentioned Montana or South Dakota because they're very small states in population, and they aren't likely to get as much attention as any of the 5 that precede them, including Oregon. So while it's not impossible that Montana or South Dakota might emerge as symbolically significant, it's more likely that the superdelegates will be paying more attention to the primary results in Indiana, North Carolina, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Oregon.
Mm-hmm. And finally and quickly, we shouldn't leave this without noting that in Pennsylvania, John McCain won a solid victory, 73% of the vote. But Ron Paul and Mike Huckabee, who were also on the primary ballot there, got more than a quarter of the Republican vote. What about Oregon? Who's on the ballot here, and what does it say about the Republican primary?
Well, the only candidates on the Republican primary ballot here are McCain and Ron Paul. So Republican voters who are dissatisfied with McCain will have to either sit this out or vote for Ron Paul. The results in Pennsylvania suggest that although McCain has made substantial progress, he hasn't fully consolidated his position as the Republican presidential nominee yet. So it'll be informative to see if he does better here on May 20th than he did on April 22nd in Pennsylvania. So I would say to our listeners, stay tuned, more to come.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Bill.
My pleasure.
Bill Lunch is OPB's political analyst and chair of the Political Science Department at Oregon State University.